Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. The Catholic Church is at a crossroads. Pope Benedict XVI surprised just about everybody this week by announcing his resignation. The leader of the world's 1 billion Catholics held his final public mass yesterday, and at the end of this month, he'll become the first pope to resign in nearly 600 years. Joining us today to explain what's ahead for the Catholic Church are two of the world's top religion reporters, including a Vatican correspondent who's written the biography of Pope Benedict. In our second segment, we'll delve into the growing debate over drone strikes and their extensive use by the Obama administration, and the rationale for secretly using the remote-controlled weapon to kill U.S. citizens deemed to be terrorists. But first, World Watch. Our international news summary begins with the so-called leader of the free world. More than 33 million people watched President Barack Obama deliver the annual State of the Union address. Domestic policy dominated the speech. But the president did stress the need to combat global climate change. He challenged Congress to pursue a market-based strategy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It's a cap-and-trade system that is already well-established in Europe. And Obama called for a free trade agreement between the United States and the European Union. And he chastised North Korea for carrying out an underground nuclear test this week, while pledging to work with Russia to reduce its nuclear weapons arsenal. On that same topic, a new round of talks between Iran and the UN nuclear watchdog in Iran's capital concluded today. Tehran Times quotes a foreign ministry spokesman as saying his country was ready to sign a deal. But a UN representative said they again failed to resolve the outstanding issues regarding Iran's nuclear program. Obama also announced plans to withdraw 34,000 troops from Afghanistan, and he declared that by the end of next year, the war will be over. The next day, the governor of Kunar province said that a NATO-led airstrike killed 3 Taliban commanders and at least 10 civilians. Amid continuing political and economic turmoil in Egypt, protesters threw Molotov cocktails at the presidential palace and caused fire damage. Security forces used tear gas bombs to disperse the crowd. And while the clashes diminished at midweek, a major protest march is taking place Friday. In Syria, rebels seized the nation's largest hydroelectric dam. This enabled them to control a large part of the electric and water supply of the country's north and east. In Bulgaria, the interior minister blamed Lebanon's militant group Hezbollah for a bus attack on a Bulgarian city resort last July. The bombing killed at least 5 Israeli tourists in the bus, as well as a Bulgarian driver. In health news, Nepalese officials have had to kill more than 14,000 chickens in order to try to stop H5N1, the bird flu, from spreading. Russia has banned all U.S. meat imports due to a chemical found within American meat. The FDA says small amounts have no risk to human health, but the EU, China, and Russia have not approved it, citing health effects to the animals. Finally, the horse meat scare is intensifying in Europe. A frozen food company is under investigation in Britain, Ireland, Poland, and France for reportedly using horse meat in some of their products that has been sold as beef. A British parliamentary report this week said the discoveries so far are likely to be, quote, the tip of the iceberg. And most recently, Sweden's food safety authorities say they'll start doing DNA tests on some supermarket frozen meals because traces of horse meat was found in the products. So that's it for World Watch. And now on to a broader examination of the biggest news of the week, the Pope's surprise resignation. Alessandro Speciale is the Vatican correspondent for Religion News Service. He's a Roman by birth and has often appeared on the world's top broadcasting networks as an expert on Vatican affairs. David Gibson is an award-winning religion journalist, author, filmmaker, and a convert to Catholicism. Gibson also writes for a religion news service, and he's written two books on Catholic topics. The latest, a biography of the outgoing Pope. David is on the line from New York. And Alessandro, you're in Vatican City, and you've been watching these historic events unfold firsthand. How emotional was the scene at the Vatican when the Pope gave his final Mass?
Well, the first impression was utter shock and surprise. People, except, I guess, the people which were in the very close Papal Circle, didn't see this coming. And so when the news was announced, the first reaction by everyone was, did they hear it right? Also because it was speaking in Latin, so yeah. Not many of the cardinals are actually that fluent in Latin to be sure that they got it right when they first heard it. And the same was for us. In fact, there was a couple of colleagues who were actually listening on into this fairly minor speech that nobody was expecting any surprise at that moment. And it took them a few minutes to actually realize what they had heard and looking for confirmation to such an extraordinary news.
Right. And David, your biography, The Rules of Benedict, captures the dramatic moments in St. Peter's Square when then-Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger of Germany was announced as the next pope. Now he's become the first pope since Celestine V in 1294 to abdicate. And were there any signs that this was coming? I know that there was talk in the Italian press that he may be retiring off and on, correct?
Yes, I mean, this was a shock because it hasn't happened in 600 years and no pope has voluntarily resigned in over 700 years, as you say. That was Celestine V back in, I think, 1294 or so. But it shouldn't have been a surprise. I mean, Joseph Ratzinger, Cardinal Ratzinger, his name before he was elected Benedict XVI, had told an interviewer a couple of years ago, he said, if any pope or if I myself don't feel psychologically or physically up to the job, it's your duty to resign. And there had been several signs, apart from his flagging energy and the difficulties he was facing, that he was really considering this move. Back in 2009, he visited the tomb of Pope Celestine, and the Pope wears a special kind of shawl, kind of called a pallium. He placed his own pallium shawl on the tomb of Celestine V. If that hadn't been a signal that he was contemplating right. that, I don't know what was. So really, I think it was people expected, ironically, this most traditional of popes, and he's very orthodox, mm-hmm. Would be the one to do the most untraditional of moves, a kind of Nixon to China move, really, for the papacy.
Right. And now the Vatican spokesman said that the conclave to choose the next pope would begin in mid-March, and a new leader of the church is expected to be in place by Easter, March 31st. Alessandro, could you give us a brief description of this strange process of picking a new pope?
Well, yes. It's a ritual that has been accumulating in centuries and is now pretty much fixed. And the cardinals gather in Rome 15 to 20 days after, well, usually a pope's death, but in this case a pope's resignation. And there is a mass in St. Peter's, celebrated by a senior cardinal that lays out the themes for reflection for the cardinals. And then this group of about 120, 117 to be precise, elderly men get locked up in a now quite luxurious sort of hotel inside the Vatican mm-hmm. and gather twice every day in the Sistine Chapel under Michelangelo's frescoes, and they vote using voting cards inscribed in Latin. And they need to receive a two-thirds majority. And the strange thing is that there is no overt campaigning, even if, of course, as a campaigning of sorts and meetings and discussions happen all the time because they have to choose. But a person who is seen as vying openly for the job
that's interesting. So following up on that, I'm going to ask each of you to go out on a limb here. Your educated guess, who will be the next pope? First, Alessandro.
Well, I seriously, honestly, wouldn't know who will be pope. And there are a couple of strong contenders. Probably the top contender right now seems to be a Canadian cardinal, which has a lot of cure experience. He's very orthodox, as Ratzinger was, but he has also an experience that spent many years in Latin America as a missionary, so he speaks fluent Spanish, and this is the language spoken by the great majority of Catholics in the world, and this is Latin America where most Catholics live, and he's Cardinal Valle. But I honestly don't know. It is quite an open conclave, and Benedict's decision was unexpected and probably upset all the calculations, and cardinals are kind of unprepared for this. My personal choice, I would very much like the Manila cardinal, a Filipino by the name of Luis Antonio Tagle, who is a warm, very simple, very touching, and at the same time, very effective person. And I think he would make a great pope, but this is just a personal. He's kind of young at 56, so probably he doesn't have so much of a chance.
Right. And David, what are your thoughts?
I think anyone who guesses is a fool. So
tell me who the front runner is, maybe.
Even though I'm a journalist, which is you're paid to be foolish. I guess the best thing to do is to direct people to the Irish online betting site PaddyPower.com, where they've got Archbishop Cardinal Scola of Milan, an Italian, at the 11-4 odds. So he's the front runner. But Cardinal Turkson, the African, is kind of second ranking. He's getting a lot of mentions. He works at the Vatican, but he's an African and from Ghana and would be a remarkable choice. And as Alessandro said, Cardinal Ouellette, the Canadian, is getting a lot of buzz. I think, you know, it really is such an open conclave, and it's so hard. I mean, you know, you don't have primaries. This isn't like a normal election like in the United States. You don't have primaries. You don't have nominating conventions. You don't have all of this kind of run-up and campaigning. And so there's no kind of even sorting out. I mean, the Catholic Church says it's the Holy Spirit who guides the cardinals, and they also say that the Holy Spirit enjoys its little jokes. So, you know, it's you can never really tell what's going to happen. Really, the big choice, I think, that's coming up here and the one that people have to look at and which makes it so hard is it's a choice between whether the cardinals are going to stick with a European and an Italian, perhaps giving the papacy back to the Italians, or whether they're going to go outside, again, to Cardinal Tagle, as Alessandro said, from the Philippines, go to Asia, Africa, Latin America, where the bulk of Catholics live. That's the big choice.
And that's where the growth, right, is in the Catholic Church.
Exactly. I mean, if you're a marketing consultant, you're going to say, look, your growth is there, but the College of Cardinals is still predominantly European, Italian, North American.
Right. And Alessandro, let me ask you this. Now, this is really unusual because Benedict, the current pope, might have an impact on this because he named most of these cardinals, right?
Yeah, he named almost 70 of the cardinals who will get a vote in the conclave.
Right. And so do you, I guess maybe David, you could answer where you think he would be leaning, who you think he backs.
Cardinal Ratzinger himself?
Yes.
It's hard to say. You know, there are a number of cardinals there. Cardinal Scola of Milan, as I mentioned, but also Cardinal Schönborn from Austria, who would be of the school of Cardinal Ratzinger. Cardinal Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, was a theologian and a scholar, and he had a real kind of, a number of disciples almost in terms of his views on theology, and a number of them have been appointed to the College of Cardinals. But it's hard to say. You know, he also knows that sometimes the papacy needs a change. Mm-hmm. You need a change just in terms of, demographics, who you're going to pick. You know,
and the church is going through a struggle. How big of an impact will this have? You know, as we said, they're at a crossroads. How big a deal is this?
It's a huge deal, I think. It's very important, I think, that the church project a sense that it hears the cries of its people. both in terms of some sort of accountability on sex abuse, the role of women, things like that. Look, whoever comes out on that balcony in March as the new pope is not going to suddenly change the church teaching on contraception, on gay marriage, that kind of thing. But he can have a different emphasis. He can promote greater openness and transparency on sex abuse. But you have to realize those are also concerns that are very North American concerns. The American church is 6% of the overall 1.1 billion Catholics. The great concerns for the church in the world are social justice, poverty, all of these kinds of things, the growing gap between the rich and the poor.
Right.
These are things that a pope from the Southern Hemisphere could really address very powerfully, and that the church, I think, everywhere would look for.
And how do people find out who the next pope is? I understand there's some ritual involved with that.
Yeah, well, there's two little details connected to it, so to say. The first one is the famous chimney on top of the Sistine Chapel. Traditionally, I mean, I think since the late 19th century, the ballots used by cardinals when electing the new pope are burnt, and a chemical is added to this ballot that's supposed to give out a black smoke if there hasn't been a consensus, a two-thirds consensus,
right,
on the name, and so if a new pope is not elected, or a white smoke if a pope has been elected. So people watched the smoke to actually tell beforehand if there had been a successful election or not.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when you actually look at it, it's very hard to tell the color from the color of the smoke whether anything happened. On the other hand, then a senior cardinal comes out of the balcony on the facade of St. Peter's and announces in Latin, great joy, we have a new pope. And that's just a few minutes before the new pope, dressed for the first time with his new vestments, stands out on this balcony and delivers his first speech and basically meets for the first time the faithful in Rome and all over the world, urbi et orbi, as they say.
Right. And David, how do you, when you talk with people and they say, you give them an idea about this Byzantine system, in the final analysis, how do you explain why they do this?
Why the
ritual and the kind of the secrecy?
Well, you know, it's such an important process, and it's, you know, they want to retain both the confidentiality but also the mystery of this selection of the pope. They don't want to see it. They don't want it seen as a normal kind of political process, the way, you know, again, we would have in the United States. I mean, it's hard to satisfy anybody. I mean, look at how disillusioned American voters were after all the very open and transparent politicking that went on in this past year or two as we selected a president. On the other hand, I guess you can go too far the other way and be so secretive that it becomes opaque, and you're denying the fact that there are politics involved, which is perfectly fine. There's an understandable that it's at moments like this, these rare moments of kind of fluidity in the Catholic Church, when you can have open debate about a lot of the unanswered questions that cannot be openly debated when there's a sitting pope. So, you know, it's an opportunity. I mean, the Church also, look, you have to realize the Church has been doing this. Cardinals have been electing a pope in conclaves for almost 1,000 years. There have been several different ways that popes have been elected over history. It used to be just the people would come into St. Peter's Square and acclaim the most popular leader or the person that they wanted. Many different systems. For the last 900 or so years, it's always been cardinals, and the conclave system has developed. It's only been the last couple hundred years that you've always done it in the Sistine Chapel, and just the last century that they've signaled the election with white smoke. But, you know, the papacy and the Vatican have been under siege over history so often that they're really concerned that no outside foreign powers try to manipulate this. Hence the secrecy. There's some you know, well-founded concerns that they have.
Now, Alessandro, this must be a tough beat. I mean, there's so much secrecy and intrigue. How do you find out what's going on?
Well, once the cardinals are inside the Sistine Chapel and they are basically locked up for as many days as the conclave lasts, there is very, very hard to tell or actually get any news. I mean, the only news that you actually get is when there is white smoke from the Sistine Chapel and you know that the new pope is about to show himself to the world. Mm-hmm. You can make speculations on if a conclave lasts many days or it's very quick, mm-hmm. that which candidate can actually profit from a short or from a longer election process, but that's very much guesswork. On the other hand, in the days before the conclave itself, even if, as I was saying, there is no overt campaigning, many cardinals have informal meetups with journalists. They give interviews in which they will never say, I think this or this other person should be pope, but they will say, I think the pope should have this and this personality, and then from there you can connect the dots.
Right. So how do you do you have smoke watchers? How do you know when it happens, because it's not like an exact time of day, right?
Yeah, you know that they vote up to 4 times a day, if I remember correctly, mm-hmm. and they do it usually twice in the morning and twice in the afternoon. So there are some hours when you know that they are in the Sistine Chapel voting, and so these are the hours to keep an eye on the Sistine Chapel.
Right. And David, how are you keeping up with this? How do you plan on knowing right when the decision happens?
Well, it's like Alessandro, the last time I was there in 2005, you know, you know when they're going to have the ballots. They have them in the morning, so you kind of have to gather in St. Peter's Square. Everybody collects in St. Peter's Square at the late morning and then later in the afternoon after they come back from their lunch break. And, you know, you look up there and you try to discern. I mean, it's such a kind of old-fashioned mm-hmm. but not terribly reliable process. Like the last time, frankly, when the smoke came out that signaled the election, it was a gray April. You couldn't tell if the smoke was white or black or gray, and everybody's there saying, "Wow, you know, all the Italians, mamma mia, che colore questo fumo." And so it was kind of, you know, it was very interesting. I think Alessandro remembers, and it wasn't really until the bells started ringing that we knew that there had been the election of a pope, and then we had to wait for another 45 minutes. He's got to, you know, you get the pope, and the other problem was that the guy who was supposed to alert everyone outside the Sistine Chapel that there had been a new pope was the new pope himself, Cardinal Ratzinger.
Wow.
And they obviously he was busy with other things. They couldn't find his cell phone. So it was very, and then you've got to get, you know, they have that special room just off the Sistine Chapel. You've got to get the mm-hmm. guy dressed in white. So they have all these new white cassocks that he has to put on, and then he has to go out on the balcony. So, you know, even after the white smoke and the bells and you know there's a new pope, you don't know who it is for another 45 minutes or an hour until he's formally announced.
Now, you know, didn't the pope start a Twitter feed?
He did. When was that, Alessandro? Just about a month or two ago, he started a at Pontifex.
Yeah, it was a couple of months ago.
Yeah, so why can't we just get a tweet?
Exactly.
Okay, now we'll have to move on to our next segment. David and Alessandro, thank you so much. This has been a fascinating discussion, a real insider's view of a complex religion. And before we begin our segment on the military's use of drone aircraft, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. An extended version of my interview with David and Alessandro will also be on our website. There you can find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program. On a previous program, we talked with peace activist Judith Bellow about America's use of drone strikes and her visit to an area of Pakistan near the target zone. Bill Roggio, a former Army soldier and the editor of the Long War Journal, was unable to be with us on the program that day. But he's with us now to provide a more favorable perspective on the practice of drone strikes. The Long War Journal website provides original reporting and analysis of what Roggio calls the global war on terror. Coverage includes strategic and operational issues relating to the conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, and Pakistan, along with Al-Qaeda's operations, tactics, and strategy. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Let's start with a basic question, but often the most complicated. Why? Why has the American commander-in-chief used drone attacks so extensively, including more than 300 strikes in Pakistan?
The answer to that is because Al-Qaeda continues to this day, 11 years plus after the attacks on 9/11, to remain a threat. And it continues to have training camps, and it continues to recruit and indoctrinate people, particularly in Pakistan, although it's happening in Yemen and other parts of the world as well. Mm-hmm. That is where a bit of Al-Qaeda's core is located, although it's not located just in the area where we're conducting the drone strikes. And we're attempting to disrupt the next terrorist attack on the United States. So that is essentially that's the basic reason for doing this.
And how effective have they been?
Well, there hasn't been an attack on the United States. There's been two attacks that almost went through, despite the uptick in drone strikes. Then one of them emanated from Yemen over Detroit in 2009. If the bomber had gotten the detonator right, we'd had a plane explode over New York, or I'm sorry, over Detroit. And then the Taliban in Pakistan attempted to conduct an attack in Times Square in May of 2010, and again, another detonator issue. So despite the uptick in drone program, Al-Qaeda still has a coherent network, right, and its allies and affiliates and Al-Qaeda itself are still plotting to attack the U.S. But I would say it's killed several senior leaders and operatives for the group,
right,
and it's disrupted their operations. It's forced them to focus on preservation as opposed to being able to openly plot attacks against the U.S. and allies. But it's not going to actually defeat the organization, and that's the way the Obama administration has sold this program. They've substituted a tactic, the drone strikes,
yeah,
killing individuals, for the strategy of for a comprehensive strategy to
right,
Al-Qaeda.
And let's go back to Yemen and the Obama administration. A recent attack in Yemen that killed two more citizens from the United States has caused some outrage and prompted the government to release a document defending the use of drones to kill people suspected of terrorism and or terrorist activity, including American citizens like Anwar al-Awlaki. Does a secret document that was first obtained by NBC News provide a legal basis for such extrajudicial killings, in your opinion?
It's a really good question, and I'm not a legal expert, so I'm not very comfortable commenting on it. I operate on a common sense, and either we're at war with Al-Qaeda or we're not. My view is that we are. Their attack on the United States and their open declarations of war, to me, gives the justification to do so. And whether if you're an American citizen fighting for Al-Qaeda or a non-American, to me, you are fair game. Look, in World War II, I don't think we, kvetched over whether we're going to kill Americans who are fighting for the Nazis or fighting for Italy or other countries. I don't think we should be doing the same here. Anwar al-Awlaki and Samir Khan, who were killed in that strike, were clearly members of Al-Qaeda. They ran Al-Qaeda propaganda. Awlaki was involved in recruiting and in operations. You just look at what they did publicly, and I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever. People wanted a trial. People want, some type of legal justification. To me, it's clear as day that Anwar al-Awlaki and Samir Khan are enemies of the United States. If you view view this as you're in a war, then it's simple. If you want to deal with this like you're conducting a law enforcement operation, then of course you would be concerned for a legal justification.
Right. Well, let's talk a bit about that, how this affects strategy. But first, criticisms of the drone strikes is that they have killed a large number of civilians, the unintended casualties. How much do we know about that?
Well, the answer is we really don't. Myself, the New America Foundation, and Bureau for Investigative Journalism all attempt to try and quantify that number. And it's, so the number of civilians killed could be anywhere from 1 to 800 out of about 3,000 plus people killed. The reality is any type of war, it's impossible to have zero civilian casualties. I think the drone campaign makes the best effort to do so, but it is by no means perfect at this. The administration has claimed in the past that there's been zero deaths or only 5 to 10, and that's absolutely ludicrous. It's not the case. Civilians have indeed been killed. But often in some cases, some of these civilians are, say, the wives or children of terrorist leaders who are being targeted. I see this quite often. And, you know, this is what happens when you're fighting a war against a group that is operating within the civilian population.
And what's your rough count? I think it's in hundreds. Is that right?
My numbers come around somewhere in Pakistan. That is somewhere around 100 or so, 100 plus. I wouldn't be shocked if that number was double or tripled. The new the Bureau for Investigative Journalism comes around. They're just to show how little they have an understanding of it, as much as I do. You know, their estimate ranges from 400 to 800, so their margin of error is 100%. So we really don't know. We're all trying to gather an understanding. I wouldn't be shocked if my number is too low or their number is too high. It wouldn't surprise me in the least. The fact is the way that this campaign is being conducted, civilians are going to be killed. I do believe the program is doing everything it can to limit those casualties. But it's impossible to get to a number of
right.
Zero.
But there has been some criticism, even from former members of Obama's counterterrorism group and retired General Stanley McChrystal, who are essentially saying that we're making more enemies than we're killing enemies by doing this.
Well, look, it's never a zero-sum game. The drones can't be all good or have all positive effects or all negative effects. I think General McChrystal's criticism was more that they're being overused, and I concur with him. They are. We should be using these sparingly. This is a problem. So the administration has basically sold the drones. They've come up with a kill strategy. We're going to kill our way to defeating al-Qaeda, but they're not addressing the core issues of what why al-Qaeda and allied groups are succeeding and thriving and continuing to thrive 11 years after going to war with them. There are cases where drones, you know, where it causes bad sentiment amongst the population, but you also see reports where people encourage them, where Pakistanis will go to reporters when their Pakistani handlers aren't there and will say, you know, more of these are killing the people that are oppressing them. So, yeah, you're going to get both sides of it. And again, I think this is why they should be used more sparingly, though. I think it creates a bigger perception problem in the Muslim world as well, that the U.S. is striking, is killing Muslims indiscriminately. I mean, that's how it's portrayed. Right. And unfortunately, you know, whether that's true or not, that's the narrative that seems to stick. And the Pakistani government doesn't help out, because while they support some of the drone strikes on one hand, they will openly denounce them, even at the UN. So they're feeding al-Qaeda's propaganda.
Now, the author of a recent Council on Foreign Relations report argues that the United States should end the so-called signature strikes, which target unidentified militants based on their behavior patterns and personal networks. Micah Zenko, the author, also asserts that the U.S. should limit targeted killings to a limited number of specific terrorists with transnational ambitions, and he called on Congress to improve its oversight of drone strikes and to continue restrictions on armed drone sales. And finally, he recommends that the United States work internationally to establish rules and norms governing the use of drones. So there are a couple of points that you agree on with Zenko. What are your points, just briefly, what are your points of agreement and disagreement there?
Well, I think a main point of disagreement, and I think he's falling into this trap, you know, this transnational threat. Al-Qaeda doesn't have, like, divisions within their group where they say, you are specifically devoted to attacking the West, and you guys over here, you're just devoted to conducting attacks here locally. Al-Qaeda doesn't really operate that way, so it's if you want to just sort of save al-Qaeda's local group or the jihadist local group, it does, you know, they don't they that's not going to solve the problem, because the same camps that are training people to fight in Afghanistan and Pakistan or Uzbekistan or, you know, in Central Asia or the or in Western China are the same camps that are churning out terrorists to conduct attacks. The same guy who's building local IEDs for Afghanistan or Pakistan is probably the same guy who is imparting knowledge to build bombs for operatives overseas.
Right. Well,
so it's really it what does the administration wants to limit to define the threat of al-Qaeda as being limited to just mm-hmm. those who want to conduct attacks on the homeland. Well, if you use that metric, you know, al-Qaeda wasn't a threat for in the United States from 1993 to 2001, the first World Trade Center bombing. There was no attacks between the first and second World Trade Center bombings in the United States. So was al-Qaeda defeated? Did they not have ambitions to attack in the United States? The answer, we know the answer is no. And they conducted, they right. still waged their jihad locally in multiple theaters. They worked with the Afghan Taliban to fight the Northern Alliance, et cetera, et cetera. We, you know, I'm not, I don't want to recap, right. you know, a decade of history there. But, you know, that it's
we're going to have to leave it there. And I really sure. appreciate you talking with us today. And I think this is a topic that will be ongoing. It's it'll be interesting to watch how it develops.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
So we've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist. Our program is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers, Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer, Donovan Ferguson and Sravani Pair were our lead producers. Please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.